subject.
Great, exciting. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, and let's start. So I'm supposed to try to explain in 1 hour how I've been doing my drawings for 25 years, so I'll try to be as condensed as I can. And the idea also is to talk of some of the mathematics and programming techniques I've been using in order to do this work. And you will see that I'm not a mathematician. I've just been fumbling around with mathematics for many years. And so I'm a user of mathematics rather than a real mathematician. And then I try to show that this is a legitimate path to actually produce art, and I'm not alone trying to explore it. And this effort and works insert himself in a little group of artists who nowadays try to do the same thing. So I will rapidly explain the concept that let me be started in doing this, and then we'll look at the mathematics I'm using and the programming techniques I'm using, and then what I'm planning to do next. And then I have 2 slides with references, which will be on the internet for people who are interested in reading about the mathematics which I use and the art inspiration that came with it. So my concept was actually simple. Looking at other art and looking at nature, and reading books that were in vogue when I started, like Benoit Mandelbrot's book on the fractal geometry of nature, you observe that a lot of things in nature are very simple and can be actually, being simple, produce very complex and interesting results. And obviously, physicists have been there making those observations as well. And the same thing happens in art, actually, and I've always been struck. I love classical music, and I've always been struck by the beauty of the art that artists like Sebastian Bach produced with very simple notes and a very limited material, which he could expand in the most beautiful things I know. And the same thing happens with many forms of popular art, like the Japanese fabrics, which actually use very simple and neat geometries produced on stencil to make their traditional fabrics. I love Islamic tilings, which are very intelligent use of symmetries, and I'm interested also in Chinese lattices. All of those very traditional forms of art actually use very simple patterns to produce visual art or music, which actually address our minds in a very powerful way. And so I have tried to use the same principles in my own way, and this is how I got started, applying those observations to visual art. The way I work, actually, has been to create simple geometric patterns and then to use them as something like modeling clay to change their shape, their nature, and add some interest to them. In order to do that, I've worked from geometry, and at some point I discovered that by moving the geometry in space using mathematical tools, I could actually give it more life, give it more interest, give it some reason that was not there in the first place. And in order to do that, I've really stuck with what I knew how to do, which was actually very simple, as you will see later. And by doing that, I also try to keep in mind a few simple rules which were coming either from my mathematical, my mathematic teachers, who was always telling us that what is true and correct is beautiful, and at the same time, what is true and correct can lead to beauty. And then my art teachers always mentioned that every time you do something, just try to make it more interesting. Find ways to make it more interesting. So applying those rules, I have used simple geometry in 2, 3, 4 dimensions. I have used fractal geometry. I have used cell similarity. I have used tilings and symmetry groups. I have used affine and other transformations. Some of them I have created and invented just for the interest of the result. And then I have experienced with things like L systems and cellular automata and function analysis and genetic programming and a number of ways to actually make these tools interact together.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Simple painter paints with a brush, and I know how he made his picture. Now, in order to understand your art, do I also have to understand what went into creating it?
No, absolutely not. And actually,
it's a complicated process that you're talking about that actually created this beautiful picture. So, do I have to understand that process that you went through?
No, I don't think so. Actually, it's probably the first talk of this kind that I'm giving, and people have been looking at my pictures for many years. And actually, I think that even myself, for a long time, I have not understood my process. I've just been doing it. But I think there is, at the same time, I have always tried to make my pictures challenging for the mind. This is why they interest me. And so I'm happy when other people are challenged. And then at some point, explanations can become of interest. But obviously, this is not mandatory at all. So I'm going to give a number of examples. For the fun of it, I noticed that in my pictures, I'm mostly using lines. And lines have echoes of filaments and threads and strings. And then I use those lines in groups, which are weaved into sheets, which has a flavor of fabrics, water, terrain, or brains. So I will show a number of details of my work, lines and spirals, and so forth. So we can start. When I use lines, most of the time they are in networks. And here I'm showing actually 3 use of those lines. These are the first one here are straight lines. And there are lines of different colors. And just by assembling them with different angles, some of them are horizontal and the other one have different angles, they actually create interesting pattern in themselves just by probably the fact of divisions and modulus that really appears in the patterns. And those lines, once you use them straight, you will see how very often I just warp them. I just give them some shapes and curvatures. And when a lot of them are together, it creates a number of things which you really want to try to understand. But I won't give explanations. This is just a perception phenomena. And so this is about lines. I'm also using spirals, all kinds of spirals from Archimedes and Theodorus and Fermat and figures by Pascal and Bernoulli. And this is a Theodorus spiral, but instead of having a constant motion, the motion at each step is random and can go to the left or to the right, be clockwise or counterclockwise. And this is why I have somewhere a little bit of a randomness in the code. And spirals are very interesting for many reasons. You find them in the work of many artists, in architecture, in gardens, in tapestries, in all kinds of things, because obviously you find them in nature, of course, as you know. And Eberhard told me that every time he look at something, he finds spirals in them. I've been using other forms of spirals, like the one I found in the work of Max Biehl, which is amply documented upstairs in the show. And you've understood that this is a polygonal line, and the way the line are being appended to each other creates a spiral of the first order, and this one is clockwise. But interestingly, the geometry of the spiral is such that it creates a secondary spiral at a larger scale, which is actually counterclockwise. And I find this figure very interesting. I've worked a lot with it. And I do not know what is its origin can be, so I call it Max Biehl, because this is the first instantiation of it that I have seen. But I think it's a really wonderful mathematical object. This is mine. Actually, Max Biehl published in 1938 a series of 15 prints and an interesting text. And the whole thing was called 15 Variations on a Theme. And actually, he did that at an early stage, and there were no computer at the time, so he limited his investigation to the eighth or ninth polygon. And so he never knew how things could be expanded by far. And actually, in his text, he has written several very interesting texts on this work and on mathematics and art, which have been very inspiring to me. And in his text on the 15 variations, he claimed that many other variations were possible, and he was inviting people to look into it, which I did. And I started doing that in maybe 5 years ago, and I still work on it regularly. I have made actually hundreds of variations by applying substitution rules to the theme to render every either a vertex or every line in the polyline in different ways, with different colors and different substitutions. And what is next is the same thing done in sand. So I have a small Mathematica piece of code to show how to generate it. And then a few days ago, as a result of being here, I've tried to do something with Eberhard, and this is the next kind of spiral which I have done. But this is, well, this is rather new, and this is using a simple formula in Mathematica. And actually, it's using Mathematica tools which I never use usually, although I explored them many years ago. But I stopped using them because they mostly produce, in their original intent, they produced pixels. And I always want to generate coordinates which my tools can use later when I actually produce the image on paper. So at the same time, just in a few hours, as soon as I got into the mechanics of the understanding of doing it, it's very easy to produce many interesting variations by just altering slightly the formula and bringing defects and colors and putting several spirals next to each other, which actually produced this one. So I think one of the things I have been learning here is that I should get back to a book which is in the library called Mathematica for Physics and understand more about phases and a lot of things that I can more or less understand, but I think should become a marvelous tool for me as well. Something else I have been using coming from my first exposures to the books and the fractal geometry of nature by Mandelbrot has been space filling curves, which really interested me, and I'm using them regularly. This is a figure from that book, and it shows how by repeatedly a certain pattern, you can divide the plane and actually cover it. And I have made many variations on that idea, and this is an example of them. This is actually a very small detail of a very large drawing, which is using a pattern which is rather complicated and which tiles very well. And it's presented actually as the dedication of Mandelbrot's book. And it's called Aliette. And it's probably someone he dedicated the book to.
His wife.
Mm-hmm. And this is an example of using the same kind of space filling device, but by putting variation using splines instead of vectors and then coloring space. You can use that as a vehicle for more exploration. And actually, when I do, this one is too dark to really be seen. These are two images which have been done by using as the underlying geometry space-filling curves of the P&O nature that was shown before. And they are there at a very small scale. And actually, the way the geometry is being designed by itself make that the space is filled in a certain order. And as I am using a primitive device like ink and on paper, the flow of ink is not constant. And as it varies with time, you can see appear the order in which all those little squares were actually filled. And it brings some life in a pattern which rendered on an Epson printer with inkjet would actually be dull. So one of the reasons for me to use those patterns was to actually bring some life and variety in the detail of those drawings.
So these are drawn with a
plotter, with a technical pen, and acrylic inks or India ink, and the plotter takes the pen over the paper, moving in X direction, the paper moves in Y, and so you can obtain whatever you want. And for some of the drawings that are large, it takes many days, actually. And it's a risky process because this is why plotters are not done anymore, because ink can stop in the pen at any time, and then there is no recovery possible. So most of my drawings I have started on one side of the sheet and finished on the other side, because there was no way to do otherwise.
So these plotters are what people used to use, and now they're just...
They're obsolete. Yes.
Because everybody now uses printers.
Exactly.
They first manufacture the picture on the computer, and then just...
And then they dump...
As opposed to in the old days...
They were using plotters, and I think plotters have been a wonderful but underused tool for artists, because when you see drawings, people are looking behind, and behind the drawing they see gestures. And so they saw the development of a line which comes from the hand or the arm or the shoulder or the entire body of the artist. You may have seen those recordings of Jackson Pollock painting, and he's in front of a huge wall and he has a brush and he jumps and he creates those lines. So for some people, really drawing is gesture. And one of the problems I have as other artists who are working in the same vein as I do is to have my work recognized as gestures, because people see gestures are being physical education rather than a mental activity. And my idea is that the gesture first is born in the brain. You have to think what you're going to do. And so as soon as you have thought the gesture, then rendering the gesture with muscles or with device or whatever should become indifferent. So the plotters were very good because they are using a little tool which could be classically should be pen and ink or felt with ink. I've been adapting it to use leads, silver leads, brushes, but it makes a gesture with a tool over a sheet of paper, So it's really coming back to the root of drawing and painting. There is an artist in San Diego, I forgot his name, Harold Cohen, who actually has built himself systems to actually do painting. So he has a real palette, and he drops colors on the palette, and he has a mechanical arm which holds a brush and can scratch a palette, get some paint, put it here and put it there. And he has used this system to actually compose natural drawings. So he was not abstract, he was trying to do flowers and trees and people and so forth. But he was using artificial gestures as well. So the problem with that is that it's cumbersome and it's slow, it's very slow, and it's unreliable. So 5 years ago, the entire industry dropped plotters, and they are not even manufactured or barely manufactured anymore. And in the space of 3 months, all the manufacturers stopped and licensed technologies from Epson and a few others, and they are making inkjet printers. So inkjet printers are faster, they are kind of expensive because inks are very expensive, and they are very reliable, but I think that the product, as far as art is concerned, is very dull because everything is the same. There is no depth in the binding of colors with the papers. There is no depth, there is no mark. It's just a very thin layer of pigments, and I think it's not really attractive. I think it's a little bit boring, but I have done some of it. Actually, the Max Bill image that I have done upstairs have been printed, but on a higher quality printer than Epson. Epson could not do these very fine works that are shown there. So, coming back to what I do, once I have the spirals or the networks of line, I used local displacements to perturb the coordinates of origin, and here I have the original line of one of those patterns, and in each point which defines this line, I have coordinates, and if I apply a certain scalar function to the value of these coordinates, I will define a vector which I can project, which move the initial P0 or P0 to P1. And so the black line after this alteration becomes this orange line. And I can repeat at different scales, and this is something that probably look like Fourier analysis and so forth, but it's done backward. Actually, I start from the simple thing and make it complex instead of trying to reverse that. And in order to do that, actually, the mathematics are quite simple. I define functions. I have complete records of functions in Mathematica, and they are very simple. Most of the time, they use trigonometric functions, and then I can combine them in parametric ways, and then I can alter them. I can make partial derivatives, and I can do apply heuristic recipes and compose them together. And once I have those functions, the Mathematica script I use splice those definitions into C templates that I have written because I don't like to program in C. So I have spots reserved in my C code where Mathematica will actually fit the different elements that I want to use, and will run a compiling phase and run the code, and the C code will actually generate the final format file that I need, which is always either EPS, PostScript, or HPGL to run my plotters. So this is really the technical part of what I do. So what does this produce? It produces drawings when I combine. These two pieces were done using almost the same function, but in different ways. The right one has several layers of different colors, and this one has just one color, but you can recognize at different scale the same variation which exists here in the small, and then you find it in a larger mode, and then this is a trace of the larger size which doesn't show in this detail. And it creates similarities, not in the geometry, but in the alteration of shapes. And also, I've been using other devices, like introducing modular variables so that I create discontinuity at the edge of the domain of each modulus. And that creates gaps, which I find interesting. They can exist in whatever directions. And they still show because the tool which I use on the plotter still run from here to there, doesn't jump. So it makes interesting lines. And in some way, it creates, for me, an illusion of more space existing than just the sheet, because you feel that all those assembly of lines belong to different things, but are just one at the same time. I've been using also symmetries quite a bit, either by scanning and drawings, which was the case here. This was a little bit of a drawing, and then repeated mirroring, which can happen in many directions. And also, everything we have seen so far can also be parameterized so that each point of the plane, which could be in 2D or in any other space, can have a number of other properties which are programmable as well, like simply color, but it could be sound, it could be whatever. And attaching different property function to space is interesting, and using the idea also of locus, where in some place something will happen, let me design change of colors around a square, or let me create these were multiple spirals in modulus environment, and this was actually looking for pixels who would actually correspond to this definition and move them on the plane. And here it allows me to make mask and leave white space and introduce colors. These are not done on plotters, these were done on printers. So I write software to handle those different functions. And I use my mathematics at two levels. One is to create objects like squares and circles and lines. And then I use it also at implicit level, which only exists in the code, which is all the methods, auxiliary methods, which are necessary to implement those transformations. And I do all that using my own software. And of course, for me, the most important thing is to have an editor and a compiler. And now that computers are faster, I only use, when I can, programming languages and shells which do not necessitate compilation. So I use Scheme, and I use Mathematica a lot, and I use Python. Once I have my sets of coordinates, then I send them to those special plotters. And I rely on traditional tools, as I said, because I think it creates all kind of interesting defects and accidents in the final rendering. The paper is scratched, the inks is spread where it should not be. It removes the coldness of pure geometry and computing, and brings nature back into the system. And sometimes there are accidents. Very often, accidents themselves can be interesting. I think I showed them in the previous talk I gave. I always use a very simple color space because I'm more interested in shapes than in colors, actually. And there is no theory beyond what I do, but the fact that I need to try often and harder and learn from one drawing to the next. Very often the functions I'm using, I use as seeds for the next development of my work. Sometimes I have discontinuity and go to something else, but I keep in store all the work I have done, all the software that I write, and very often I can create with that library, which I will reuse differently. And so I combine my tool in a kind of a constant research.
Do you preview on screen, or do you just wait?
Now I preview on screen, but for probably 5 to 10 years, I could not, because I started doing that when there was not even graphic screens. So the only thing I could see was my codes and my functions. And then I could only see the final result when it was coming out of a plotter. So slowly things have evolved, and at some point I could have graphic screen, but they were very low resolution, as you can remember. So I was not seeing much of anything. And now it's different because it's easy to have much higher resolution on computers, and also the software which is used allow one to zoom in and out very easily. So this is different. But I've been really trained to actually work with my closed eyes, because there was nothing to look at. Well, as everybody, I want to have a contribution to the field. And actually, there is not really a field, as we will see. But actually, I've been trying to define a mathematical language for conceptual compositions. And I'm using that in such a way that I always try to give a proof of the concept. So in a way, I'm a conceptual artist. But every time I do something, I just don't want to stop at the concept. I want to produce and see something. So I'm sitting between these two worlds. And this is a very quick history of art and mathematics. There has been a big surge of art and mathematics in Renaissance, where Platonic solids and other polyhedra were very highly in vogue, and Piero della Francesca, Leonardo da Vinci, Dürer, Jamnitzer, Kepler worked on that intensely for many years. And then the thing was forgotten and had a resurgence at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1905 or 1907 till 1930s, where you had the Cubist and the Bauhaus and artists like Piet Mondrian, Lissitzky, Max Biehl, Escher were actually heavily involved in that field. And then it started again in the 60s in New York. You had a whole school of abstraction geometry painters. And I mentioned there are a few names like Agnes Martin, Ellsworth Kelly, Bryce Marden, Frank Stella. There has been a number of shows organized on this work, and a few books have been written on it also. And so now there is some comeback. And for instance, there will be an exhibit at LACMA next year called Beyond Geometry. And there is now a show that starts traveling between different campuses, starting at University of Minnesota, called Contemporary Art and the Mathematical Instinct at University of Minnesota. I'm part of the show. There are about 30 artists. I listed all their names. And many of them have websites and information. So I will try to add a collection of URLs so that everybody interested can actually look at their work. So what next? Well, I've been learning a lot here so far. And I've been very interested by some of the work I have seen from experimentalists and theorists. I have learned again what PDEs were. I had forgotten for many years, and I think there is a very wonderful world for me to explore there. And so I'm decided to get into a new phase of evolution in my work. I'm going also to learn more math, and I'm going to struggle with Sean's book as much as I can, because I think it's very well done, and to me a chance to grasp the notions that are evoked there. And I'm also working now on constructing new devices to actually make drawings in different medium like sand. And I'm also working on several projects involving large paintings on the plotter. I still have four plotters. I have two plotters that can handle pen and ink with either technical pen or brushes. And then I have two others who can actually handle graphite lead and silver leads. I've been doing a number of pieces using silver leads because I really liked the idea of using a technique that was really proper to Renaissance when drawing emerged. And this is what Durer was using. You take silver and you use it to draw on a surface of paper which has been prepared with something abrasive, something that has a tooth. So the tooth takes some particles of silver as you draw. And then they get oxidized and takes a very nice and weak color, but interesting color. And then with the different artists who works in this current field, we're fighting to get our work recognized because this is a challenge. I'm sitting between several worlds. When I am with mathematicians, I'm an artist. When I am with artists, I am a mathematician. And it's difficult to get what we're doing recognized. But some people in the field are clearly mathematicians. One of my friends is Ilhaman Ferguson, and he has a PhD in math. He works with a federal agency on cryptology. And he does wonderful sculptures in marble, in granite, in bronze, illustrating theorems in bronze. He has written a book, which David Gross has. I let him have the book. And he's truly one of the best artists of the field because the power of the tools he's using and his dedication also to using traditional medium, which really talk to the senses of the beholder. And then I will give you a peek preview of a side project which I have. David Gross has asked me to work on several mugs and t-shirts and other things, which is something I have never done. And I decided to try to do that in a fun way. So here I need to explain. We have the P universe. And here we have some Calabillo figure, which should be rendered more beautifully so that people can recognize it. And here we have the KITP spaceship exploring our light cone above UCSB and trying to reach 10 of the 90s particles. But I do not know if this is funny or of interest or should be censored. I'm just showing what I have done. And then this is the coffee mug. And the detail of the spaceship. And this is a detail of what is around the coffee mug. Here we should have this Calabillo thing again. And this probably a cloud of Rayleigh-Benard cells. And here a schematic design of galaxy. Then I have spent some time with the infamous Calabillo image. And actually, I have done something with it, which actually I found interesting. This is a typical representation that you see everywhere now. And I actually simplified the parametric definition of it by exploring just a very small fraction of the total space. And when you do that, you remove most of those polygons. And you get to this, which actually shows that the structure or the topology of this figure is actually the topology of a very complex Möbius strip, which would have been cut and self-traverse itself in many points. And if you use the definition of this beast in several space size. This is in, what have I done here? This is done in six dimensions, and so you find, is it six or seven? You find as many of those centers as there are dimensions in the space which is defined. and you can do that at different scale. And you see here that the strip, which starts from what is in the shade and the dark here, will actually slowly turn. It will traverse this other one and gets in a different orientation to the next center, and so on and so forth. So one of my other ideas for the coffee mug was actually to take this more transparent rendering of that object and including it several little KITP towers again, because the tower is a landmark of the institute. And then I did that at several scales, but it's not very apparent. And I tried to put it in color, but then we lose the towers. So this is a difficult problem for me to solve. Any help from anyone would be really welcome. I will show that tomorrow with Rosalind in the writing seminar. And well, these are the reference slides, so they will be published. So this is the end of the talk.
Any questions? Do you have a movie of the scent?
Yes, it's somewhere. I have to find it. I know at least it's upstairs on a little portable disc. Here, I'm not sure.
So what in Europe, while he's trying to find the movie, so he has an XY table like a plotter, right?
Yes.
And the XY table is sitting under a table, which is a very thin, it's just a big table, you know, it could be about this size here. And then underneath the XY plotter writes, and there's a very thin layer of special sand, which is very specially selected, I learned.
Yes.
And it is a 1-inch stainless steel ball, which is being moved by a strong magnet on the XY table and then writes the pattern into the sand. And the features of the patterns are much, much smaller than this 1-inch ball. The features are down to, I don't know, less than a millimeter, even less than that. So what's used is really the granular medium, which gives you some, there's some real physics. I mean, the granular medium lives and acts and does whatever it does. But underneath is actually the structure. And it's I've been visiting your peer at home, and it's just so relaxing to watch this. I mean, you sit there, and it takes, how long does this take, roughly?
This was the first device I built. It was very slow. It took an entire afternoon, which you can see, because first the light was blue. It was a northern light. And then suddenly the sun started turning, and so the color becomes warmer. And then at the end, it's dark, and this is electric light. We can do it again. Actually, I would like to see if I can make it larger, full screen. I don't know. Yes. So that was the morning, and this is noon, and this is the afternoon, as the sun went by, and this is electric light. So I have a couple of others. I started doing that when I realized that the sun garden in Kyoto and elsewhere were actually drawings on gravel. And if they were drawings, I decided I should be able to do that. And I made that device. And what is interesting in the device is that the action is hidden, because the ball that runs on the sand is actually moved by a magnet that actually travels under it. So a lot of people ask silly questions when they see that. So this was the same one, also very slow, and started the next morning, took an entire afternoon, ended up in electric light. And I cheated there, because I ran it first, and then I located where the free spot were, where I could have those rocks. And then I placed the rocks, and then I ran the same pattern again, and it just appears to know where the rocks are. But actually, one of my projects, but it just takes some time and money, is to build one of these with a standing camera on top, so that it would become interactive. You could actually lay the rocks wherever you want, and the camera will actually record where the rocks are, and the computer will read those images, define the positions, and displays the initial pass so that it will actually collaborate with you and do it without cheating in a way. And then I have probably a few others. These are time-lapsed, of course.
I mean, the ball is rolling around every
time. This is a computer mouse ball.
Okay.
Well, and everybody who wants to see it live is welcome to come and visit my studio, and we'll have a preview.
Are there attempts to represent higher dimension of space, for instance, using color to code other dimensions?
Yes, I've tried to do that. Actually, in fact, once I had a conversation with Sean, and I was telling him I have seen in Brian Greene's book that we are living in this four-dimension space that I am more or less familiar with. But then we have all those extra dimensions which are curled, and this is more difficult to understand, and it would be much easier if instead of being dimensions, these were properties like colors, and actually multispectral properties could be involved. And I often do work where I try to make correspondence between higher dimensions or higher phenomena and actually the pixels or the lines which I will put on paper. I've tried to do also work that try to relate words with shapes and color with words and shapes. And I'm planning with Bob Sturm, who is sitting here with us, to try to do the same thing with music. But for that, for many years, I've been stopped by the difficulty of inputting a music pattern or musical patterns data that I could use to generate drawings. But I'm hoping that we'll be able to work around that.
Okay, well, if there are no more questions, thank you up here again.